our Bibles open again to page 1209. I think it will help us a lot to be able to see for ourselves. If you'd rather look on a phone, that's fine as well. But there are some more Bibles at the back there for us. Verse 32 of Hebrews 11, the writer says, I don't have time to tell you about Gideon, Barak, Samson, and I fear I don't have time to touch on much of this brilliant and rich chapter, but I hope I can give us a bit of a taste for it so we can go away and read it a little bit more ourselves this week. Chapter 10, verse 39 shows us why we need this. It says, we are not those who shrink back and are destroyed, but those who have faith and are saved, which reminds us of three things that we've been looking at in this series in Hebrews. First, the need to persevere. It's no good just to start the Christian race if you don't finish it. The crown, the rest, the promised land is at the finish line, and we need to persevere. Second, there is a real danger of shrinking back, of falling. And we saw that tragically with the Israelites. They fell. And none of us, therefore, should be complacent and think, well, you know, I trusted in Jesus. I went to church, and therefore I'm fine. Third, we need to persevere. There is a real danger. The key to finishing is faith. We are those who have faith and are saved. And that raises the question, well, what is faith? Maybe you're here and you're not yet a Christian. It's great to see you. And you're thinking, well, what is this faith thing that Christians talk about so much and we've mentioned a few times in this service? And perhaps you are a Christian, but you're struggling. You just feel battered and bruised. And actually, the first readers of this letter, the Hebrew Christians, felt exactly like that. And you're thinking, how on earth do I keep going with faith? And others feel like they've just dropped out, other friends of yours. And you think, how am I going to hold on? There may be that instead of those two things, that you just want to grow and you're a practical kind of person. You think, well, you talk about growing in faith, but what does that actually mean practically? Give me some real life examples. Make this concrete. Well, that's where Hebrews chapter 11 comes in. Because in it, we meet some Old Testament believers who made it. And we can think of them like a crowd lining the way as we're running a marathon. And they're cheering out to us, we've made it, keep going. And I think that those Old Testament believers might give us two particular lessons today. Here's the first on the screen. Faith refuses to make its home here. Have a look down at verse 1 with me. Now, faith is confidence in what we hope for, and assurance about what we do not see. It's kind of a definition. It's saying that faith isn't just a vague religious feeling. And that's what a lot of people think, isn't it? You've got this sort of strange feeling thing here, your faith. No, faith is a settled confidence about something in the future, something not yet seen, sure, but promised by God. And so it will come about because God will bring it about. Faith is a confidence in God's future. And so faith refuses to make its home here. And we see that with this character, Enoch, in verse 5. He's a kind of mysterious character who by faith is taken away from this world to be with God. I wonder if that just happened to you right now. How did you feel? It's a few people going, not bad. But faith, this world was not Enoch's home. He didn't settle down. And we see it with Noah in verse 7 there. By faith, Noah, when warned about the things not yet seen, in holy fear built an ark to save his family. Now, the history there is that Noah was probably living in a desert region when he received this warning from God, I'm going to flood the world. The God who first gave life was going to take it because of people's gross wickedness. And so Noah starts making an ark, a great big boat. And it took him decades of his life. And you can imagine some of his mates coming out to him and saying, oh, come on, Noah, a flood? Where's the evidence?
Oh, God's spoken to you, has he? Really, come on.
I can't see any clouds, Noah. And all this talk of judgment is very negative. Come and live a little. You're missing all the fun. But Noah had God's word on it. And faith is taking God at his word. And so he knew that this world would not last. And so he threw all his energies and focus and money and prayer and effort into getting his family into, well, what was almost like another world. And there's a challenge there for us, isn't there? As we call people to cling, not to a wooden boat anymore, but a wooden cross, the cross of Jesus. We're going to look very foolish, but faith refuses to make its home here, because here won't last. Abraham did something very similar. Verse 8, by faith Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith he made his home in the promised land, like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents. Now, for Abraham, faith in God literally meant getting up and moving. He lived with his family in Ur of the Chaldeans, worshipping their gods. But God called him, actually, as a very old man. So if you're somebody who's older and yet you're discovering faith, it's just like Abraham, who's 75. And God called him to get up and to go to Canaan. So Abraham traded in a proper house for a drafty tent. He traded in security and stability for a life on the move. And you can imagine how infuriating it was to constantly have to sort of take down the tent and then put it up again. And, you know, you bang those tent pegs and they always seem to bend. He's probably thinking, what have I left? What am I doing? And then as he wrestled to understand the foreign language and practices, that we had that experience last week visiting some friends in Italy, that feeling of not quite belonging or understanding what's going on would have helped Abraham to remember where he really belonged. I'm not home yet. There is, verse 10, a city with foundations whose architect and builder is God. Now, a number of us in this room have lived in Lansing all of our lives. Others, like us, you know, we've moved in more recently, but we want to settle, you know, for years and years. Some are in the process, perhaps, of buying a house, or of redecorating, or of extending, or of sorting out the garden. Those are all fine things to do. But remember, friends, Lansing is not, and could never be our home long term. It is not your true home. If you're a Christian person, you do not belong here. There is a city with foundations. That means it's lasting. Whose architect and builder, it's planned by him and built. This is not going to be shoddy, is it? The God who built this world, even though it's fallen, it's so glorious and wonderful to enjoy, he has a better home planned for us. There is, verse 16, a better country. Yes, even than this. There's a heavenly one. And that is hard to look forward to, isn't it? Because, of course, we can't see it. But faith is the confidence in what we hope for and the assurance about what we do not see. And maybe, like Abraham, being called to live in that flimsy tent, God might use some difficulties in your life to help you not to just settle down. You're renting, and you just wish you could buy, but you can't. Or the roof is leaking again. Or the children have drawn on the wall that you newly painted and have torn off half the wallpaper. Or the garden isn't coming up how you'd like because the slugs have just eaten almost everything you planted. Or you're feeling a bit homesick because actually you grew up in another country. Or there are just things about Lansing that wind you up, like the broken glass constantly on the street. And you feel, this just feels so temporary, so fragile, not quite home. Well, friends, that's because it isn't. It isn't. There is a better country, a heavenly one, calling out to us. And therefore, we don't expect to fit in. Are you someone who loves to fit in, to dress the same as everyone dresses, to talk just the same as everyone else, to eat and drink just like everyone else, if you've got children, have them have all the same technology and lifestyle as all of their classmates? I think most of us do, don't we? But by faith, verse 13, we are, whether we like it or not, foreigners and strangers on this earth. And we're refusing to fit, refusing to settle down, or to make our home here. Even in death, you know. Verse 21, how do you die well? There's a question for over the dinner table and the lunch table later on. How do you die well? Well, verse 21, by faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of Joseph's sons. He's looking for God's blessing in their lives, more than any material inheritance that he might be able to pass on to them. He wants God's blessing over them. And Jacob worshipped as he leaned on the top of his staff. So he's not cursing God. God, you didn't give me long enough. God, you didn't answer that prayer. You didn't heal me. He's worshipping. He's loving and longing to be with his God. And death will be for him just a little door which he walks through right into that. That's how you die well. I want that. Well, second example, verse 22. And by faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions about his bones. Now, that sounds pretty weird, doesn't it? I imagine nobody in their will. Rebecca works in the funeral industry. I don't think anyone's ever kind of written in their will, I want my bones to be taken out of here and planted, you know, in that land in 400 years. But that's what happens. So Joseph was, the story worked out that he ends up as number two in Egypt. And so I imagine he was given a pretty awesome burial. You think of the tombs of the pharaohs. But he says, this is not where I belong, even after death. And God has promised that there is a better land than even the fertile land of Egypt with all its treasures, and that he's going to take us there. And I want a part of that. And so just to help you remember, in my will, my dying wishes, take my bones with you when God delivers on this. And it was 400 years. But it did come. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for. Now, friends, it's not wrong to want God to act and on his, it's not wrong to want God's promises now, but we do need to get our expectations right. Did any of these guys that we've looked at actually receive the things promised in their fullness? Have a look at verse 13. See if you can answer that yourself. So God had made some promises. Did any of them receive these things fully? Answer? No. They did not receive the things promised in their fullness. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance. That is a very important thing for us to remember. I and the elders had a morning of prayer the other day, and of course we long to see cases of mental health that are just making some of our congregation's lives just a misery. We long to see that taken completely. We long to see bodily healing and pain just removed completely. We long for godliness to be made easier for each of us, and for God's presence and closeness to be tangible and constant. We pray for these things rightly, and for some people, God acts right now. But in one way or another, for all Christians, we will find, verse 13, to be true, we'll still be living by faith when we die. We won't receive everything God has in its fullness now, but we'll welcome it from a distance. And that is one of the problems with something called the prosperity gospel. You might have come across that, churches that falsely promise that if you have enough faith, you can have perfect health and wealth now, that you can have heaven and feel absolutely at home now. No. It's only when Jesus returns that all our prayers and hopes will be fully answered. Like for these guys. That's real faith. It's not a lack of faith on our part. It's biblical faith. Not actually to see that much now, quite often. Indeed, what we may see is just one another slowly falling apart. Still living by faith when they died. Faith refuses to make its home here. Let's come to the second thing from this passage. Faith refuses to make decisions the way that everyone else does. Now, most people make decisions by what they can see, but faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. And so Christians are going to make daily decisions, big decisions, small decisions, differently from everyone else. We can see that with Abraham in verse 17, for example. By faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. Now, this is a unique and difficult story. I preached a full sermon on it 2 years ago, which you could download if you want to go and have a look at that. God's call here to Abraham seems absolutely crazy. And all the more so because, verse 18, God had promised Abraham that his plan would continue through his son Isaac. So verse 19, how did he make that decision? Abraham reasoned. Now, we're often told today that faith and reason are kind of opposites. Not so. Abraham is thinking fiercely. He's letting this overrule all the fears here. That the God who gave Isaac as a miraculous child in the first place could bring resurrection. Would have to do something. And in fact, God provided a ram substitute instead. It was just a test. And God never wanted Abraham to go through with it. And we need to be very clear, this is not something we'll face. But we can learn from this reasoning by faith that Abraham brings to his decision-making. Even agonizing decisions. I will trust God despite that awful thing that has happened in my life. Because I reason that God could be still good somehow. I will follow God, even though it may seem to ruin all of my hopes and dreams. There's that relationship the Bible says I must turn from. There's a commitment that will lead me away from church or from serving, and I'd love to go and do it, but I will sacrifice it. Because I'm ruled by faith and not by the fears of my heart. Faith refuses to make decisions the way everyone else does. Have a look at Moses for another example of this. Verse 24. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Now, the background to this is that the Israelites had been slaves to the Egyptians, and they were treated really harshly. Indeed, around Moses' birth, the Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, had decided to cut the numbers of the Israelites by killing all the firstborn sons. So Moses' life is in great danger. He just escapes, and he ends up, by a sort of twist of, well, God's sovereignty, raised in Pharaoh's household as the son of the Pharaoh's daughter. So when it says that he was known as her son, that would have carried the most enormous prestige and power and tremendous prospects and a great education. And when it talks about the pleasures of sin, That would have meant, if you think about it, all the parties and food and women of Egypt with really no accountability at all. He had this top position of power. He could have done whatever he wanted. And when it talks about all the treasures of Egypt, think of the tomb of Tutankhamun. And that was just what they buried them with. And Moses turns away from all of this. You can imagine his mates saying, "Moses, what the? Like, you were one of us. You had everything. And you're..." Even I imagine some of the Israelites might have said things like that. "What are you doing, Moses? You've got this opportunity to make it." But Moses chose, verse 5, he chose to be mistreated along with the people of God instead, to side with this rabble bunch of slave Israelites who seemed weak and in a minority and like they had absolutely no future at that time. Jamie's old church leader, Vaughan Roberts, tells of meeting someone at a sort of town function, and the man asked, "What are you up to at the weekend?" And Vaughan said, "Oh, cricket on Saturday, church on Sunday." "Oh, I suppose some people go to church. What I can't abide is those evangelical churches." "Well, actually, the church I go to is an evangelical Bible-believing church. Well, I suppose they're not all as bad as each other. It's St. Ebbs in town that seems to be the most disturbing." "This is awkward. Actually, I go to St. Ebbs." "Oh, do you? Well, at least I suppose not everyone there is, quite so hard line as their minister, Vaughan Roberts." Perhaps we should have exchanged names at the beginning of this conversation. Let me introduce myself. I'm Vaughan Roberts, the rector of St. Ebbs Church. Nice to meet you. Standing with God's people often means disgrace, being mistreated. Perhaps on a Sunday, you scurry into this building because you just worry a little bit that a friend might see you coming in. Maybe next week you could just linger by faith at the door, just for a little bit. That would be just a little step as you come in. And if someone asks you this week, "What are you doing at the weekend?" you're brave enough to say, "I'm going to church." Yeah, to that Bible church on the high street. It's a hard thing to do. I do door-to-door on Saturdays. And interestingly, yesterday I had a strip torn off me for being a Bible-believing Christian. And it's not fun. And a guy just wanted to sort of basically shout at me for about 20 minutes. You're not one of those kind of Christians. I don't mind the kind of cultural Christians who sort of just go a little bit. But someone who really believes this stuff? Maybe you're heading off to university. And the call here is to side with God's people, even if they're actually just slightly odd. I've heard people say, "Well, I didn't join the Christian Union because they were just a little bit this or a little bit that." What would Moses do? Maybe some of us could start a Christian meeting at work. Just say, "We'll just have a little prayer gathering." Because for many Christians, standing with God's people, like with Moses, was enormously costly. On our holiday, we met a 25-year-old lad who'd been a Muslim but was converted, and on the Saturday, so we saw him on the Sunday morning. On the Saturday, he'd rung his dad in Afghanistan, who said, "We will never talk to you or see you again." Absolutely devastating. Why would someone make such a decision? It's verse 26. "For the sake of Christ, as of greater value than all the riches of heaven." And Moses was looking forward to his reward. Now, part of maturity, any parent is kind of hoping for this, for our children, is delayed gratification in the present to wait for something better in the future. And God had promised eternal blessings to the people of God. And though Moses could not see them at all at that moment, all he saw was a group of people who were oppressed and looked like they had no future. And he could see very clearly what Egypt had to offer. Moses took God at his word. Faith refuses to make decisions the way everyone else does. Now, it actually worked out pretty well for Moses. You know, it doesn't always. Verse 25, just have a look on. Sorry, not verse. Verse 35. Others were tortured, refusing to be released so that they might gain an even better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging and even chains and imprisonment. They were put to death by stoning. They were sawn in two. They were killed with a sword. They went about destitute, persecuted, ill-treated. You know, often faith and making decisions of faith will mean that we actually lose out in this life. Lose reputation, lose status, lose, like these first believers, their homes and their possessions, lose their families, like that Afghan convert. We'll never miss out in the next. I hope you know that. Whatever sacrifices you feel like you've made of time and money and reputation, you won't miss out. Moses sided with the people of God. The second little thing he did there, verse 27, by faith he then left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered. Why? Because he saw him who is invisible. There was Pharaoh before him with all his officials and chariots, visible to the eye, terrifying, the most powerful man on the planet at the time. But Moses knew there was a higher throne and a greater king. Do you know the words of Andrew Melville, the Scottish minister? He stood before King James VI and said, "Scotland has another king, whose kingdom, King James, is neither lord nor head, but subject." How we want our young people to grow up with that sort of courage. Not afraid of what their friends will think, because they, like Moses, see him who is invisible. The third decision Moses made is there in verse 28. By faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood. Now God had sent a whole load of plagues to kind of wake Egypt up and to say, let my people go. And the final plague was that all the firstborn sons in Egypt would die. And that was true of the Israelites as well, because like the Egyptians, they were not worthy. They had sin that needed to be punished. But there was a provision. And God has said, if you take a lamb and you take this perfect lamb into your house, then that lamb could represent you. And then you killed the lamb and you put its blood over the door frames of your house. And then the destroyer would pass over them. There was to be a death in every household, but the lamb would die instead. That seemed pretty strange, but Moses took God at his word. He made decisions the way no one else did. And the Passover provides us a really helpful picture of what Jesus does to rescue us. We too deserve a judgment. There must be, so to speak, a death in every household. But just as the lamb died in the place of the Israelites, so Jesus dies in our place. And as we trust in Jesus' death, not our goodness, but in his blood for us, we can be absolutely confident. Faith is being confident of what we hope for. Refuses to make decisions the way everyone else does. Now, most of us don't have huge crunch moments like Moses. It may be there's someone here and you are at a kind of real crunch moment. There's a kind of, I need to make some huge changes here. Well, what a great week to come in. And will you make the decision based on faith in God or just the way everyone else does? That's the challenge. But for most of us today, our days are just made up of lots of little decisions. We are the choices that we make, someone said. Will I read my Bible today? Will I take some time to thank God today, or just decide to ignore him or grumble? Will I give or just save? Will I join the church clean or keep Saturday week for me? Will I come out to a prayer meeting or stay in to watch the telly? Every day has a whole host of just little decisions to make, and we can make them just like everyone else, or by faith. That's quite common today for people to say, I'm a person of faith. Have you heard that? I'm a person. I have my own private faith. Now, where that means I just vaguely believe something, then, of course, someone's free to say that. It's a free country, isn't it? I'm a person of faith. But if it doesn't really impact my life, my decisions, my commitments, I hope you can see that it's not the faith of Hebrews 11. And so if that's you, God is calling you to something much better. A faith like Abraham, Jacob, Moses, that is bold, decisive, real, makes a difference in our lives all the way to death. A faith that can actually save us as we cling to Jesus. Most of us do have that faith. If you're anything like me, you feel you've got a long way to go. These believers in Hebrews 11 challenge us. They stretch us. I hope they inspire us. Their God is your God. The faith God gave them, he gives us. So will you refuse to make your home here and refuse to make decisions the way everyone else does? And will you do that to the end of the race by faith? Let's have a moment's quiet, and then we're going to sing a song that reflects very much on this chapter.